Thank you, Yessie. My name's Pat. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Christine, my wife, for telling me that I was going to be her 10-minute speaker today. I will try to get as much as I possibly can in the 10 minutes up here. But, this is a good time of the year for me because, God willing, Thursday I'll be able to celebrate another milestone in my sobriety, and I'll have 18 years. That's a big deal for a guy like me. I was reflecting this last week. This time 18 years ago, I was running amok in Signal Hill, Long Beach, California. And I didn't want to. I didn't care if I lived. I didn't care if I died. All I cared about was making sure that the pain would go away. And I drank and did other things to make that pain go away. And at that time, all the things that I was doing wasn't numbing me anymore. At the time, I didn't see all of it, but God saw fit for me to get arrested one more time. I didn't have that relationship with God. I didn't want God in my life because it was because of Him that I had all these bad breaks in my life. It wasn't me. I was staying out of the way. I wasn't hurting anybody. I was just minding my own business. The reality of it is I was hurting a lot of people. I didn't know anything about recovery, 12 steps, Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in my cell. I was fighting an assault case. They wanted to send me upstate for 3 years. And the guy I was in the cell with tells me about a rehab. And I'm looking at him kind of confused. I'm like, well, I don't have any broken bones. Why would I need to go to a rehab? And he's like, no, stupid. It's, a rehab for having a alcohol or drug problem, And I'm like, he goes, it might get you out of jail, going up, getting a number. And I'm like, all right, I'll try it. And I did that. I went to court and I asked my public defender, and she goes, well, I'll go talk to the DA. And the DA came back and said, no, we're not dealing with them. And 22 days prior to that, I was in the same jail, and I was in that same courtroom fighting another assault case. Luckily, I was in a courtroom where a judge was known to help alcoholics and drug addicts. And the PA, and my public defender went to her and asked her if I could have a rehab. And the judge looked at me and said, will this keep you out of my courtroom? I'm like, sure, why not? And that's how I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to, I had to do some time, some county time. And then they sent me into a rehab for 4 months. And I got into the rehab and I was like, all right, I'm here, I'm cool, And I started going to these meetings and I still wasn't feeling right. I still had a bunch of anxiety and I was still as angry and, I was doing all the things the counselor wanted me to do and I still wanted to fight and one of the guys that I was friends with in there, he said, you need a sponsor, dude. I'm like, well, what's a sponsor? You know, I'm not an athlete, so how am I going to sponsor? You know, and he goes, no, somebody's going to come and help you, you know, work these steps. Well, I can walk fine. I don't need to learn how to walk steps. But so I'm like, all right. So they had this outside panel come in, and this guy was talking, and he had cigarettes. I'm like, cool. It's my sponsor. You know, and I talked to him after the meeting, and I said, hey, can I smoke? And he gave me this pack of cigarettes. I'm like, all right, cool. Yeah, well, you know, I'm looking for a sponsor. You want to do that? And he gave me his number, and he goes, well, call me Sunday at 6 o'clock. I'm like, okay. So Sunday about 5 o'clock, I took a payphone hostage because I wasn't going to let anybody use that payphone because I had to make a phone call at 6 o'clock. You know, and 6 o'clock, I had a clock, and right when it hit 6 o'clock, I dialed that number. You know, and he was surprised that I called. He goes, I get my number out all the time. I didn't think you'd call. I said, well, I'm calling. I go, I almost got kicked out, but I'm calling. Why'd you get kicked out? Because I was going to beat somebody up for using the phone. But anyway, so, you know, he worked with me. He came, and he loved me when I couldn't love myself. Or I didn't know how to love myself, I should say. You know, and that's kind of how I started in this program. You know, we worked together. He gave me the opportunity to come live with him. I chose to go back home. And that was probably a bad mistake. I didn't relapse or I didn't do any of that, but I was in an environment that was very dysfunctional, that nobody knew anything about living life on life's terms, you know, and I had to get out of there, and I did, you know, and I can't say that the last 17 and some change years was the greatest, but it was a hell of a ride, and I enjoyed every minute of it, because I can remember every minute of it, you know, the good times, the bad times, and then the just okay times. You know, I've learned that in this, being in this journey, that I have a memory like an elephant. I can remember stuff from years back. Like my wife will sit there and tell me something. I go, no, that's not how you said it. You said it like this. Well, how do you know? Because I know. And, you know, and she's like, oh, man. So she's very, you know, cautious of what she says now. But it's good, though. You know, fast forward up to last week, you know, let me back up a couple years. I had, in this program, I've learned to be an employee. I've learned that I get up in the morning, I go get my coffee, and I go to work. And I did that, you know. When the job market hit and it was terrible, the only jobs that were available were crane operating jobs. So I put myself through crane operating school, got my crane cert, and went to work in the oil fields and made great money. You know, and it worked for a little while, you know, until I couldn't stand up straight. And I had to have 3 back surgeries. You know, and at the time when I was having these surgeries, I had a really good surgeon. He had told me, you're more than welcome to go back to doing what you're doing, but just guarantee that you will be back to see me. And I didn't know what to do. You know, I'm like, so I went home and I had a conversation with my wife, and we ended up deciding that I needed to go back to school. You know, and I'm 44 years old, switching careers, you know, and this last Friday, I had the opportunity to participate in Bakersfield College graduation ceremony, because then I graduated with an associate's degree in psychology. And that was a miracle for me, you know. I had family and friends there and people writing on my Facebook page and telling me how proud they are. And, you know, that was overwhelming almost for me. You know, And like I said, you know, God willing, if I don't walk out of this room and fall in a bucket of alcohol, you know, and roll down the hill into the bar, onto a stool, I'll get to celebrate 18 years on Thursday. You know, and I didn't even think I was going to live to be 29. You know, and actually, if you kind of think about it, I died at 29 just so I could start beginning to live, because that's when I walked into these rooms. You know, I surround myself by people that have the same wants as I do in this program. I golf with my sponsor once a week, maybe twice a week. I hang out with my brothers in sobriety. I had an opportunity last night to go with my sponsor and two of my really close friends to the Dodger game, all paid for from another member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Got to go into the Dodger Stadium Club, all the food paid for. I mean, it was like gourmet. I was like, whoa, you know. I mean, they had shrimp. I mean, they had fish and steak and chicken and lamb. And I'm like, wow, this is Dodger Stadium? You know, and we got to sit there and desserts. We ate and watched the alumni game. And then we went and sat 9 rows from the field. And I'm like, wow, I'm just a drunk and I get to do this today. You know, if you're new, you're starting your journey, welcome. Grab a hold of your seat. Grab a hold of somebody that has something that you want. And I'm not talking about a bike, and I'm not talking about a boat. I'm talking about some peace and some serenity. And ask them how they did it, because that's what I had to do. I was told early in my recovery to come early and stay late. And I did that for about a month until my sponsor asked me, did you get any numbers? Well, no, you just told me to come early and stay late. You didn't tell me to talk to these people. He says, well, you know what? You need to go back there and start talking to them, getting numbers. You know, that was my response to everything he said. Oh, whatever. You know, and that's what I did. You know, and I'm grateful that I did that. You know, there's a lot of times that I had to do things that I didn't want to do. Because not because I couldn't, is because it had to do with putting work in. You know, but I'm grateful for every moment that I had to put work in. Because you know what, if I didn't, I wouldn't be standing here today. Thank you. Hello, my name is Pat. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to now introduce the main speaker, Christine from Bakersfield.
Hi, I'm Christine. I'm an alcoholic. Just give me a minute while I get my timer going so I don't talk over the 45 minutes. Can everybody hear me okay? I was told I needed to get closer to the microphone. All right, so I'm grateful to be here today. Happy Mother's Day to everybody. I just got a whole list of expectations at my table, so I'm a little nervous, to say the least. There's a, you know, if you live over 50 miles, you better be good, is what I heard. if you were referred, you better be good, and I was referred. You obviously have spoken before. I haven't. You know, like, there's a lot of shit going against me at the moment. So just bear with me. And we'll just take a moment for confessional. I'm a type A. And, you know, for those of you that don't know me, I'm very type A. I work as a salesperson for a living. I play roller derby, and everything in me right now says run. This is not what I like to do. I've managed to turn down the AA request to be a speaker for almost 16 years. But today is my debut, so I'm hoping for an award afterwards. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I get to give away what I have in order to stay. So thank you for reminding me of that. Anyways, now that we got all that nervous energy out of the way, I'm like I said, I'm really grateful to be here. you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. And the only way I know to share my story is to share a little bit of who I was, right, and why I drank. And I think the history of why I drank is very important in order for me to understand how to recover and get better and heal. And there's a lot of patterns that took place in my life starting at a very, very, very young age. And a lot of them I learned, and maybe some of them I was born with. But I can tell you that some of my earliest childhood memories set the scene for my entire life. And I fight some of those demons today. But I remember at a very young age, my mother waking me up. I was probably about 3 years old. She woke me up in the middle of the night, and she was leaving my father. And I don't know why, and it doesn't matter why, but she was leaving my father, and she was taking me with her. I was the youngest of three children. We were all 5 years apart. And we got on a plane in the middle of the night, and we flew to California, and we went to stay with my grandmother. And in a three-year-old's mind, I had no idea how long the time frame was. But it, in hindsight, I was told it was about 6 months. And the way my dad got me back is that he kidnapped me back. He showed up unannounced with a friend in a car, and I was getting in the car with my grandmother. I think we were going shopping, I'm assuming. And he literally came in and he snatched me out of the car, and they were having a tug of war between the two of me. And he finally slapped her in order to get her to let go of me. And he snatched me and he took me and put me in the car and flew me back to the state that we were living in. And he did that to get my mother to come home. I mean, that was the way they loved each other, evidently. I'm not really sure. But, of course, you know, that was a really long time ago. And in today's day and age, they would have been in prison, right? I mean, that would have been like an Amber Alert situation. But, you know, So my mother was a runner, you know. They didn't have the most healthy relationship. I don't have a whole lot of memories around that particular relationship. But I can tell you in that same house where we lived in Idaho, there was also a house across the street where these people babysat me. A lot of times my mother was a nurse, and so she worked nights. And my dad, I think, at the time was doing some Christian counseling. He had gone through seminary and he made donuts by nighttime or something. I'm not really sure of what they were doing. But I know I had gotten in trouble because I used to go across the street to the little boy's house and we played doctor. Right? And, you know, like harmless stuff, you know, when you're three. But mommy found out about it, and she told me she wanted me to stop going over there. But I kept going back. And that was a pattern for me for a lot of things later in life. And I think it kind of set the scene on the fact that I liked to not feel the way I was feeling. And that was something that I sought out to change the way I felt. My parents later divorced, and my dad, I mentioned he was a pastor. He also he worked as a police officer for a couple of years and had a lot of odds and ends jobs, and he's passed on. But my mother was a nurse. They divorced when I was 8. My earliest childhood memory of drinking was at a family gathering. I think I was probably 5. I didn't drink alcoholically, but I probably would have if I could have. We were at my mother's family's house for a Thanksgiving or Christmas, and everybody around the table got a little bit of wine. And in a 5-year-old's brain, I think I thought I saw a full glass of wine. But my mother says, in our justifiable manner, oh, it was just a swallow. Again, I don't know who gives their 5-year-old wine. It just doesn't seem like a normal thing to me. But we all had wine. And so I had a glass of wine, or what I thought to be a glass of wine, and I really liked it, and I asked for more. And she said, no, of course, no. Like, of course you're not going to get more wine. Who gives you wine in the first place? But I got wine in the first place, and I liked it, and I wanted more. And my grandmother and my grandfather, on her side of the family, they had a cocktail starting around noon all day long. And I remember very vividly always asking Grandma, she had gin, if I could have a little sip of her, whatever she was having. And it was awful. But for some reason, I always asked to have a sip of it anyways, right? So my mother remarried to a man, a family friend. I protested the marriage. I thought it was very unhealthy, and it just didn't make sense to me. My dad was allowed to get remarried, but she was not going to be allowed to get remarried to this man. I thought it was really unhealthy and it just wasn't right. And my feelings turned out to be right because he was a pedophile. And he never ever put his hands on me. He was too smart for that. Because my mom was smart. She had told me if anybody ever touched you, that was definitely wrong. You needed to tell somebody about that. So I spent from the time I was 8 until the time I was 13 being manipulated. And all of my sexual boundaries were completely blurred. So he started in this magnificent way of, telling me that about the things he liked sexually, or the things that he and my mother would do, or that I was acting sexually inappropriate. And the conversation progressed. But he would also let me do really cool things. Like at 10, I was driving a car. Or when my mother was going to work at night, we were going for donuts or ice cream. I never had to go to bed on my scheduled bedtime. I mean, so he had my trust. There was a lot of trust there. And it was just enough of a conversation to make me feel like I was responsible for that conversation. And I knew enough that maybe it wasn't right, but because I was continuing to have the conversations, I was definitely feeling guilty and ashamed. And I couldn't go to my mother and tell her about him. And that same man told me that there was demons outside my room that used to watch me undress. And that same man masturbated in front of me. And that same man manipulated me for years into believing that I wasn't going to live past the age of 18, that I was going to be having sex at a very young age. I mean, the conversations got sicker and sicker and sicker. And so I really didn't have very good, healthy sexual boundaries. Even when I, as an adult, I mean, it followed me for a really long time. My stepbrother tried to rape me at 13, and he apologized. So later, when I became sexually active, I slept with him anyways. And that's just all of that at 8 set the scene for all of the reasons why I used and drank. I was so gross. I was so disgusted. My dad was a pastor. He counseled people for a living. My mom was a nurse. And granted, it didn't seem like I lived in a dysfunctional life. I knew something was off. I would come home from school, and the police were at my house on a pretty regular basis because my stepbrother was always having outbursts of anger. And there was a lot of high-level, intense feelings going on in my home. My mom took a lot of pills. I mean, Valium was definitely her go-to and would be today if she was allowed to have it. But so this was a norm, this, like, constant chaos, anxiety, uncertainty. It was just the way I lived in my home with my mother. And then I would go to my dad's, and it was not nearly as crazy, you know what I mean? But he was the weekend dad, and he eventually moved with his new family to another state, and I got to visit him on the weekends, and I would call during the week, and it just, he was removed due to divorce. It was what it was. So I told my mother about everything that had happened, and I specifically remember we were, I told her about the rape, the potential rape or attempted rape, and we were going to move to Idaho. We were relocating. She was going to move me to Idaho. She was leaving the husband. He was never to be seen in our lives again. I went to stay the summer with my father. And on the way to the California border, we were driving. On the way to the California border, she announced that he was meeting us there. And I knew in that moment, like, everything I thought to be good and true and the fact that my mother was supposed to protect me and do what was right had gone out the window, and I hated her for it. I hated her. Every single fiber and hair on my being hated her, and life as I knew it changed. Like, I checked out in that moment at 14 years old. I thought, F you, forever. And unfortunately, I mean, fortunately, actually, I've been able to do a lot of work on all of that. And unfortunately, she was just doing the best that she knew to do. There's no excuses for it. Like, our alcoholism, like, leads us into this delusional thinking, you know what I mean, where we can justify any situation, any decision. I can follow it up with some sort of excuse well, it is what it is. And I can still do that. I've worked a lot on getting through all of that behavior. But anyways, So, California border, met the stepdad back at the border, and ended up in Idaho, and as shortly thereafter met, when we lived there, I was 14, and I met a neighbor. She was also 14, and we became best of friends. We had our first drink together. It was Mad Dog 2020. I mean, like, first official drink, right? The first one where you actually get trashed. And I remember, like, it wasn't a drink, and I had no intention of it being a drink. And I think there was multiple bottles of it in different flavors, and orange and purple and, you know, just whatever it was that we could get our hands on, because we were only 14. And I think her older sister was having a party with some 18-year-olds, and I'm not sure how we got it, but we got it. And they were okay with it too, and I was good with it also. And I definitely was already smoking cigarettes, and so drinking was just next on the list. And I don't know where my mom was. I mean, like, she was always kind of absent, like, emotionally, but I was in the backyard and thinking, man, this is good. Like, the room was spinning, and I felt good, and, you know, like, everything was good, and I needed more, you know, and I didn't get sick, you know, like, I got drunk for the first time, I didn't get sick, and I didn't get sick physically a whole lot when I drank. That probably would have deterred me. Whiskey was my Achilles tendon when it came to that. But so I drank, and that was good. And then it wasn't long after that that I literally jumped right into acid. I mean, I'm sorry, drugs is part of my story. I won't focus on it a whole lot, but I didn't, like, ease into anything ever. You know, I dropped acid, and I, you know, immediately started smoking pot, and I smoked some crack, and, you know, I mean, and it was on. It was on. And, I mean, it wasn't on to the extent where I could use daily, because I was 14, and so money and the means was limited, but that sexual behavior that I talked about was also on. That was on and cracking. And, you know, it there was really, once that green light happened, there was no stopping it. And I didn't need an excuse or a reason. Just like for my drinking and using, I didn't need an excuse or a reason. I just slept with everybody all of the time. And I used and I drank all of the time, as often as possible. Sex was a little bit more feasible because it was something I owned. I could use it and do it whenever I wanted. But alcohol took me away from the guilt and the shame of all of the other stuff. And it made me not have to think and feel and remember, and I could blame my behavior on that. Oh, I had been drinking, or gosh, I was drunk, or, you know, all of that gross, disgusting behavior that just followed me for a really long time. So I did a lot of that for a lot of years, you know, and I don't really need to share, like, my lifelong log, right? But it worked for a long time. Drinking and using got in the way of school, so I quit school, not drinking and using. That wouldn't have worked. So I quit school, and I got a job, and I got a job at a drug rehab. It was so awesome. I worked in the kitchen, and I would actually see my friends go through the line, like, because I was serving food, and I would see and they were like, "What are you doing here?" I'm like, "Oh yeah, you know, I just haven't been caught yet, and I had moved out of my mother's house, so I didn't have anybody to put me in rehab, and it was like the perfect scenario because I get really stoned and go to work and eat all the food in the pantry." It worked really well until that stopped working too, because our addiction and our disease and our alcoholism gets in the way of those responsibilities, those things that were, you know, where we need to suit up and show up no matter what. That just doesn't work. It doesn't go hand in hand. So I quit that job, and I got married, thought, you know, I'll get some responsibility going on in my life. I got married at 18. I married someone that was 12 years older than me because I had daddy issues, evidently. And I was really good at being a weekend drinker, a weekend warrior. And I had a professional job, and I held it together for a while. And I got divorced, and then that all went out the window, and the party was back on. So I lost everything. I actually gave it all away, pretty much. I decided to do a relocation effort because the house had been taken. I still had a little money in my pocket, enough to get to where I was going, could make my car payment, and I was going to clean up my act when I got to Lake Havasu, Arizona, the party capital of the world. I'm not sure what I was thinking. My brothers were there, and they said, come here, we'll help you. I mean, seriously, that was like, come here, sister, come on here, we'll help you. And I don't know what I was thinking, because I got there, and they were high. You know, and they kept it a secret from me for a long time. Well, I don't know, long meaning like 30 days. And I caught on to what was going on, and I threw in the towel, and I joined the club, and then I bartended, which was like the perfect job for an alcoholic, right? Like, you're in, I don't know, like Candyland, you know? I realized at that time, like we hear in our readings, you know, like I'll switch from beer to wine and scotch to brandy or whatever, you know, like drinking on the job, not drinking on the job, weekends, you know, all that, like that was totally me. And so much so that the owner is the one that would put me on those regimens, like, okay, you can't drink hard liquor at work, okay? And I'm like, oh, sure, no problem. You know what I mean? And then it was like, okay, you can't drink at work, period. You know, like, this isn't working. You know, because in Arizona, you can drink with the customers, which was really cool. Like, oh, you shop for me, shop for you? Cool, yeah, that's, it's on. So yeah, the alcohol got out really, really out of control. And I had a girlfriend that I hung out with because I, at that time, really kind of saw myself more as a drug addict than an alcoholic. I mean, I really had a problem with speed. That's what I thought was my problem. I didn't know then that alcohol was a drug and, you know, it was the gateway and it would lead, this is where it all started. I didn't understand any of that. I really didn't know what 12 steps were. In fact, I had a customer once pull me aside and say, hey, you know, have you ever thought about maybe hitting up a meeting? A customer at a bar said that to me. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, maybe, you know, like, what's this got to have, you know? Well, his mom was like a speaker in the circuit in the other program. And he's like, maybe you ought to check some of that out. And I went, yeah, okay, you know. And, yeah, so it everything got out of control. And so I had a girlfriend, and she would get sick in the morning if she hadn't drank. And I so couldn't relate to that. I was like, God, you really have a problem. You know what I mean? Like, this is really getting, you might want to lay off a little bit. Like, you're getting sick in the morning when you don't have a drink. Like, that was crazy to me. But what I didn't realize is I had my own level of sickness going on. Like, if I wasn't using, I was having anxiety attacks. And my anxiety attacks were completely self-taught. Like, now that I look back on them, I didn't naturally have anxiety. I'm not an anxious person. I know I seem a little nervous, but that's because I don't speak. But, I wasn't having anxiety attacks, you know, just as a whole, right? So the concept of being without my thing or whatever it was that I was using at the time, I would have an anxiety attack. So I learned how to have anxiety, which really worked out at the time. But it was really crazy because as I decided to get sober and I was still having the anxiety attacks, I remember one time at work, I up and left the job. I was like, see ya. I didn't even say goodbye. I just left the job. I went home. I got in my bed. I pulled the sheets over my head. Full-blown anxiety attack. My brother came home, and he, like, peeled him back. And he's like, are you okay? And I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. I've learned how not to have anxiety attacks. The program has taught me how to work through all of that and take one step at a time. But, you know, so it's crazy, like, the learned behavior that comes along with our disease, right? We start picking up these little tools that work to our advantage to help us stay sick, you know, and we have to undo all of that when we get here. But the bartending job I got fired from because I accused the bartenders of short pouring, which is hilarious because you shouldn't do that when you're sitting at the bar that you work at. The other customers don't like that either. So I accused the bartender of short pouring me at the bar that I worked at, which doesn't go well. So I got fired from that job. And I ended up, well, I don't have money anymore and I don't have a place to live anymore. So I'm couch surfing and I'm like couch surfing at this girl's place, the girl that throws up in the morning for not drinking. And she has really bad cockroaches and it's just not looking good anymore. You know, it's just not, things aren't going so well. So it was tax season and I called my brother and I said, I need help. And he was at home. He had moved home because that's what we do. We all move home when we need help. And he was at home and he said, oh, well, you should move back to California and, you know, and I'll, we'll help you, you know. So I said, okay, but I can't get myself out of this town. Like, I have $300 or $400 tax season. I'm behind 3 months on my car payment. I'm homeless. I'm jobless. And I just know the concept of driving out of this town is I'm going to have an anxiety attack because I'm leaving my medicine behind, and I'm not sure where I'm going to be able to get my next fix. And so I need your help to come get me. So he got on a bus, and he came and got me, and I got him high when he got there. Not a good thing, but anyways, so we drove to Mexico and got more drugs, and then we finally made it back to California. And I, like, moving home, I moved in with my aunt and my uncle, who are psychologists. So, like, literally, we're living in a petri dish of dysfunction, you know. And my mother, you know, my master enabler, my number one fan. And so I move home, and I'm, like, at 22, 23, somewhere in there, you know, conceding to the fact that maybe my way isn't the right way. And the crazy thing is like, I still wasn't going to meetings at that point. I didn't know what AA was or 12 steps or Narcotics Anonymous or anything. I didn't know what anything was, right? I just knew that what I was doing wasn't working, and I still just had a problem with one specific thing. And so this person hunted me, literally, I am not kidding you. Like, have you all ever experienced, like, when you're ready to get sober, how the shit comes out of the woodwork to find you? That is exactly what went down. Somebody followed me from Lake Havasu and hunted me down and called me and said, let's hang out. And I was like, oh my gosh, what's happening right now? You know, like, you weren't there when I wanted something, and now you're hunting me down from another state? Like, what the heck, right? And my disease was like, yes, go. And so I went, and I was like, I'm not partying, like, I'm not using, you know. And he's like, no, it'll be fine. You know, don't worry, trust me. And I'm like, okay, cool. So we get in the car, we go back to this hotel room, we walk in, and we open the door. And I so remember, like, we open the door, and there's everybody doing what we do. I'm like, oh, my God, what are you doing to me? There was no, like, okay, let's leave. I'm like, what are you doing to me? Let's go. You know, like, let's go. Those people that he had brought with him had been breaking into cars, stealing identities, and had shops set up on recreating IDs. And I mean, and I was deathly afraid of prison, like jail. I don't know how I avoided it, but that fear was a healthy fear for me. So after about 24 hours of partying and not checking in with my mom or brother and being on the missing persons list, he said, I got to go. You got to get me out of here. And those same people later were arrested and went to prison. And, like, I just scraped by that. Like, I was so lucky. But it was, so, like, I got home, did the walk of shame, right, back into the house. You know, like, the whole family's like, there's the bedroom. Go sleep it off. You know, see you in a couple days. And they loved me so much. And I woke up to, like, a bowl of vitamins in my face. Like, you know, like, my brother's like, here, have, take these, you know. You want to go to a meeting? I'm like, So I went to my first meeting that night. And I remember sitting in that meeting. That was back in the days when you could smoke in the meetings, and it was really dark and dingy. And I started in the other fellowship, and so I just felt really at home at that time there. And I remember not being able to sit still. I was very antsy and anxious and kind of feeling like I was going to crawl out of my skin. And this guy looked at me from across the room, and he's like, keep coming back. Like, how does he know? How does he know that I'm going crazy right now, you know? And there was some lady talking about being kidnapped, and I'm like, I I've been kidnapped. Like, you know, there was like just little bits and pieces of things that I could relate to. And I left that meeting and went to the bar. You know, I mean, it was like so perfect. You know, like I went to my first meeting because I had a problem with another substance. And I just never really can put the two together that alcohol was an issue for me. So I spent another 6 months drinking. I thought I was better, and I got a sponsor, by the way. I worked some steps. I took chips. I went to meetings. I took chips, claimed sobriety, but I was still drinking, and I was probably doing other things, too. But, you know, I mean, you lie about it so much that you just start living the lies, but I definitely wasn't sober. Let's just put it that way. And my moment, back to the sex thing, my moment was I must have picked up somebody from the bar and took him back to my mom's house. This wasn't behavior that was out of the norm, by the way. I was doing that anyways. And so I'm not really sure why this was my moment, but this was my moment of clarity. Like, this was my aha moment. My aunt walked in on me with this guy, and I was so mortified because they had been so loving and kind to me. And I was like, it was like being caught in the act. You know what I mean? And it wasn't like 16-year-old caught in the act. You know what I mean? It was adult, shameful caught in the act. And I don't think I sent him home though, but so awful. It's so gross. Okay. So anyways, the next day when he went home, I cried and cried and cried and cried and cried and cried some more to my aunt, the therapist, who's super loving and understanding. And, you know, we're all just living our own journey. And she's like, why are you so upset right now? I go, I just can't believe that here I am one more time, completely and utterly mortified. You know what I mean? Like that moment of demoralization where you're just disgusted at your own behavior. That was that. That was that moment for me. And thank God that happened, because I haven't had to drink since. And it's been almost 16 years. The glory in all of that is the recovery that's come along with it. You know, I didn't immediately stop all of the bad sexual behavior. You know, we come in here as women, and we bring all of this garbage with us, and we don't know what it's like to be respectable women. We think because we have such little love for ourselves that we have to lay on our backs in order for the men to pay any attention to us or to be accepted or have any value. And it wasn't until my husband at the time we were dating told me, you don't have to do that in order for me to love you. And what? Really? Like, poor guy probably eats the words now, but like, how about a little love? Just wanted to see if you were all still awake. So I am. You know, so I finally decided to step completely into the program and admit that I have a drinking problem, right? And I started working steps. And I worked my first 6 steps a couple of times, and then I moved. Well, let me back up. I worked my first 6 steps, and then I moved, and then I worked them again. And then I sat for a really long time, and I realized that my having a sponsor out of town in another program probably isn't the best for my recovery. And so I decided, you know, and when I moved to Bakersfield, I decided that Alcoholics Anonymous is my home. That's where I belong. I really love the fact that we use the word God in this program, and I understand the concept that we have to talk about a higher power so that we don't chase people away, and we all have a different idea of what that higher power looks like in our own lives, but for me, it's God. And so I felt the level of spirituality kind of step up a little bit for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so Alcoholics Anonymous has really been given me the ability to you know, conduct myself with grace and dignity in most situations. I'm nowhere near perfect. I have a long ways to go. But my dad died. I'm sorry. Let me just back up for a second. My husband and I adopted a daughter in this program. At my 5 years, I was in a meeting, and in the spirit of Mother's Day, I'll try and keep this short, but it's applicable. I was in a meeting. The woman came in. She was very pregnant, 7 months pregnant, and I was celebrating my 5 years, and she was new. She was identifying as a newcomer, and so I went up, and I gave her a hope candle. I hope you keep coming back. Later to find out that she wanted to give her child up for adoption, and we were in the right place at the right time, and we were, you know, poised to be able to adopt that child. It was a very touch and go for the following 2 months of her pregnancy, and because she was using, I didn't think that we would end up with the child until one night we got a call, and she said, I'm in labor. My husband had abandoned the concept and told me to stop pursuing it. And then I said, she's in labor. We got to go. And he was like, what are you even talking about? So we drove 3 hours to Pomona, and they wanted to drug test her. And I'm desperate at this point for a baby. Like, I need a baby in my life. This is the next indicated step. I'm married. I'm clean. Now it's time to be a mother. And they want to drug test her. They want her a urine test. And she's like, they want a urine test I used today. And I'm thinking, oh, no, social services is going to step in, and they're going to snatch up this baby, and I'm not going to get it. And this is self-will run riot in the sweetest form possible. And I go, I'll test for you. My husband went, what? You'll do what? Yeah, I got this. Don't worry. There was that moment of pause, like, you know, pause before you act thing. Okay, maybe that's not such a good idea. The deal is that if God wants me to have this baby, I'm going to end up with this baby whether you test dirty or not. And I literally am going to walk in total faith in this second. And so she tested dirty. She also told them that she intended on giving the baby up for adoption. Social services stepped in. They did not take the baby. We took the baby home from the hospital. And they only did one home visit to make sure that I didn't give the baby back. So my daughter's 11 now. And I think that's a great testament to, you know, how my will versus God's will. So, you know, we get here, we start working steps. We think we've got it. Oh, yeah, I've checked the boxes. I've worked the steps. Now we've got to apply it to our lives, right? So, you know, I've admitted that I'm an alcoholic. My life has become unmanageable. It's even more unmanageable when I'm trying to control your life, too. I have to identify a God that, you know, that I can have a relationship with in step two. And step three, I turn my will and my life over to God as I understand him, you know, and then I take it back, and then I give it, and I take it back, and I give it on a pretty regular basis. And, you know, and then I clean house, I do some inventory, I start taking a look at my character defects, and I get to make an amends where applicable, and then give away what was so freely given. And, you know, it just looks so nice when we talk about it in that pretty package, you know what I mean? Like, wow, man, she's really done some work, you know? And then we get some time, you know, and I'm guessing a lot of you have quite a bit of time. And we get some time, and it's like the longer I'm sober, sometimes the more my disease talks to me. Not because I want to go out and drink, you know, not because I'm thinking about, you know, especially when it's bad stuff, right? Like my dad, I started to say my dad died a couple of years ago, and the last thing on my mind was about going and having a drink. It was, on the contrary, all the opposite stuff, all the stuff that the program taught me. This is the time I need to take the tools out of my toolbox. You know, I get to apply, I'm doing the right thing even when it doesn't feel like the right thing, you know, or treating people with love and kindness no matter what, you know, I'm making my side of the street clean, making sure, you know, I mean, so in the face of diversity, I feel like I present pretty well, you know. It's when things are going well that I get complacent, you know, the complacency, the gift of desperation has been removed, and I'm no longer willing to do whatever it takes. It's more a matter of convenience. You know, what do I have to do today that fits into my life? And that's scary. That's a scary place to be, and that's a scary place to go. I'm grateful. I stay connected, you know. I go to I'd like to say I go to a lot of meetings, but I don't. It's an honest program. There's too many people here from Bakersfield. I got to keep it real. I go to a women's meeting very religiously once a week. And, you know, the program has given me a life to live today, and that means it's full. And I know meeting goers stay sober. So I'd like, you know, one day maybe I can go to more, you know, but right now I'm a student, I'm a mom, I'm a wife, I'm an employee, I'm a roller derby girl. I'm, you know, I'm a sober person. I mean, there's a lot going on. You know what I mean? So I go to a meeting once a week, and you all can judge me however you want, but that's the way it works for me. And I have a sponsor who has a really long time sober, much more than me. I think close to, 40 years, actually. And we've worked all 12 steps together. I talked about how I got stuck up till 6 for a while. We worked all 12 steps together. And that gift of desperation was such an amazing gift for me, because for a lot of years, all that behavior that I had as a child, living with a pedophile, thinking that I had no value, that disgust, that shame, that gross feeling, it followed me. It follows me. And working the 12 steps has given me the ability to feel comfortable in my own skin. You know, to be able to take a look at what was mine and what I needed to own, and the fact that I don't have to pick up that big club and beat myself over the head with it. And I realized the triggers that cause that feeling to happen, you know, when I'm stressed or there's unmanageability going on or insanity or whatever it might be. When I start doing that, I can go, whoa, you know, like, this isn't good right now. I need to get reconnected with God. I need to spend some time in prayer and meditation. I need to, when I'm feeling really miserable, I'll call a sponsee and see if they're more miserable than me. You know, like, get out of myself. Help others, right? Sorry. That's the way it works. I only have 7 minutes left. I'm doing really good. So I worked my 12 steps and I, you know, for the first time in my life, you know, I started feeling a lot more relief than I had ever felt before. And, I have the pleasure of being able to work with, sponsees today. What a gift, right? To be able to run through those steps all over again with someone else that's been struggling, you know, to stay sober, you know, to sit and say, you know, and like compare notes on experiences and just say like, hey, you know, I get you. I feel you. I understand what you're going through, you know, to lend that branch and help them know that they're not alone. You know, I'm not very good. Like I'm of the cloth where it's like, I'm not really great at patting you on the ass and saving your face at the same time. You know what I mean? I kind of tell people how it is. You know, because you just can't deliver sobriety in a pretty package all the time. You know, sometimes hearing the truth is painful. But if you can't trust me to be honest with you, then what do we got? Where are we going with this relationship? You know, this sponsor-sponsee relationship. But I have a very short fuse for being a person's counselor if they're not willing to be in action and, you know, working on the solution. So that's kind of the same you know, method that I apply to my own life. You know, I have to live in the solution. I stay in the problem for like a second. Our dog died recently. My husband was the one that had to deliver the message to my 11-year-old that we had to put the dog down. And he allowed her the day. He's like, look, you have the day to go to bed and like pull the covers over your head and be upset and sad and cry and all of that. But then tomorrow we're moving on. And that's kind of the same concept. Like, look, here's some, you know, like here's life. You get a minute, you know what I mean, to absorb it and just, you know, and work through it. And then we're going to get into the solution about it. And I can literally take just about any one of the 12 steps and apply and circle it back into any situation that I'm going through, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. Sometimes I need outside influences to help me work through that. That's why I'm so blessed that I have a husband that's in this program that speaks the same language as me. It works great when I'm open to it, and I hate it when I don't want to hear it. You know what I mean? But, you know, about a year ago, So my mom's older, and she takes medication, and my husband's had some back surgeries, and he was taking medication as prescribed, and I like medication. You know, like, I don't need a reason. I'm very aware of that, by the way. It's part of my disease. And so, like, anyways, I don't need to get in the disease part of it, but I was having some bad, I was under some stress. And I, you know, and I was thinking, like, my disease was doing push-ups. It was ready to roll. And I said, you know, and I was feeling the stress of it. I don't think about getting loaded or drunk very often, but it happens. I'm not cured. And so he came into my office and I said, listen, and I was in tears. I just have to say this out loud. Like, I need to say it. They told me I got to say it to get the power out of it. I feel like I should be taking medication too. Like, all of you are on medication. Where's mine? He's like, okay. The part was, I mean, it was kind of funny and not at the same time. Like, I talked to my sponsor about it too, but the deal was, is I felt like at 15 years, 14 years, wherever I was in the moment, I couldn't believe I was feeling that way. Like, I don't know, like, I feel like I should be further along. My disease says, like, I don't have anything to offer. I, you know, like, who really wants to hear your story? You know, like, all these things, all this negative self-talk starts happening. I, you know, like, you should be better than this. You should be further along in your steps. You need to rework. You know, like, this disgusting tape starts in on where I'm at, what I'm thinking, and all of that. And so I needed to say it out loud. And my sponsor told me, hold on a second. First of all, you're doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing. You're calling me and you're saying it out loud, right? And now we get to talk about where that is stemmed from. Where is that coming from? Why are you feeling these things? Where are you at with, you know, all, like, you know, to circle it all back into the recipe for living, you know, and let's get back in the solution. You know what I mean? Like, it's okay that you're in the problem, but let's get back in the solution. So anyways, I wanted just to say that to, you know, anybody that might be here that, you know, struggles with your sobriety or is feeling guilty or has that negative self-talk that goes on or, you know, or picks up the club or whatever it might be, you know, it's just a lie. You know, because our disease is out to kill us. It's not here to help. It's not here to make you feel better about yourself, you know, or tell you attaboy or attagirl or good job or, you know, you're on the right track, you know. I mean, like, we have to combat that with all the good stuff that our God has in line for us. You know, the fact that he loves us perfectly and that we are children of God and we are made in his image. And, you know, and we are meant to recover. You know, as long as we get up and we come to a meeting Sunday morning and we have some good breakfast and we network with each other and, you know, we share our stories together and we kumbaya and hug each other, you know, we're going to stay sober for another day. So thanks for letting me share.